Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. For lunch, I had a cheeky bowl of pasta, boiling hot water straight onto the pasta. Then I had a glass of sparkling filtered water to accompany it, straight from my tap also. It is just magical. I love my Cooker tap. For more information, go to cooker.co.uk. Right. It's spelt Q-U-O-O-K-E-R. It's pronounced Cooker because it's Dutch, but it's, I suppose we'd say Quicker, but it's not. It's Cooker. Cooker.co.uk. Today's hour, I'm curious about weight loss and getting ripped. To talk me through this and all his thoughts on it is superstar personal trainer James Smith. James is a personal trainer who has made himself into a multi-million pound business with a no-nonsense approach to fitness and diet. He's written three books, not a diet book, not a life coach, and Food for the Soul. He also has a best-selling app, James Smith Academy Fitness app. I have to admit, he wasn't really on my radar until I heard him on Amy Fuller's podcast. So thank you for that, Amy. I like the way he spoke about diet. I like the way he spoke about exercise. And I like the way he spoke about life. His whole approach seems to be brutal honesty. And I must admit, I was drawn to it. So let's meet him. Here's James Smith. James, hello. Thank you for doing my podcast. How are you?
Very well. Thank you for having me on.
Have you done a workout today?
I have. I've just come from Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu.
Oh, you're into that, aren't you? Everyone's madly into Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. You can't listen to a Joe Rogan podcast without him banging on about Jiu-Jitsu. And Sam Harris. They're all doing it, aren't they?
It's an interesting one because I came from a background of rugby for about 15 years. And you kind of miss that contact, man on man, the hugging element of it. And you can go do it every day. Jiu-jitsu gym, but it's great to be able to do a sport on your terms where you don't have to wait for the weekend to play.
How do you do socially distanced jiu-jitsu? How's that going down?
At the moment, we're doing it in households, inverted commas. So I've had several people as part of my household, even though I live alone. But it's a sport that I can see myself doing for the next 20 years, which I don't think many 30-year-olds can honestly say to themselves.
Yeah, my mate got into it and he started doing it 7 days a week. He loved it so much. But there was a few things that, because he kept on saying, come along. And I said, oh, I was quite injured at the time. I'm not as injured now. I had a bad back and I thought it was probably not great for a bad back. But he was picking up quite a lot of injuries because he insists on fighting people who are better than him, which he says is the jiu-jitsu way. Always fight people who are better than you because that's how you learn. And the other thing is he kept on buying like special soaps to antifungal soaps and stuff. And I was like, what? And he goes, yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of fungus being spread in a lot of sort of bacteria being spread.
It does get pretty close and personal, but it's interesting that your first belt was a white belt and then you have blue, purple, brown, black. It takes 10 years minimum to get a black belt, but the white belts are the most dangerous. A white belt with good intentions will injure more people than a black belt with bad intentions. Right. And everyone's really weary of him. So your friend was probably a very keen white belt. Everyone's kind of keeping their distance, and the awkwardness of how keen they are to get into the sport is often where, you know, fingers get broken or, you know, little bumps. There can be injuries, but I just keep myself away from the white belts.
Right. What are you now?
I'm a purple belt now, so I'm about halfway. I would like to think.
All right. Okay, let's get a quick summary of you, because I listened to you, as I was saying in the intro on Amy Fuller's podcast, really thoroughly enjoyed it. But I loved the way you talked about diet, I loved the way you talked about fitness, and I love the way you talked about business and life in total. So can we do a quick summary for my listeners if they don't know a lot about you?
Yeah, so do you know what's quite interesting? I haven't told you this since coming on air. About 10 years ago, you were at the cricket at Lords. I believe it was Lords. It might have been Edgbaston. And I was actually sat next to you.
Ah, and?
It's when you came up for the podcast crest, I said to Luke, who organised it, I said, I sat next to Tim Lovejoy once at the cricket. I didn't say anything. I knew you were at the time. This was before I was a personal trainer. And I think it was like quite a good little way into it was that 10 years ago, I was corporate. I was working a 9 to 5. I was doing the right kind of normal thing, you know, getting pissed at the cricket or whatever. And I was someone that was very jealous of personal trainers. I'd watch them on Twitter and I'd go, how's someone doing that as a job? And got to the point at probably 24 where I was like, I've had enough, quit the corporate world, became a PT. And even charging 30 quid for a session, I thought if I do three of those a day, you can make a living. And I wasn't living in London, I was in Bracknell. And having that kind of relaxing position where I just need to train three people a day. I got very busy quite quick because I enjoyed what I was doing. Did thousands of hours of PT on the floor and got a bit bored. Although I was doing well, I got bored. And very randomly decided to move to Australia to what I would think would be the capital of the fitness industry. And when I got there, I didn't like the culture of fitness there. Quite toxic, not very supportive. It was 32 personal trainers in the gym. And I was kind of forced down the avenue of going online because you pay about £200 a week for your rent just to be on the floor. And I was in a 12-month contract and I couldn't afford to be paying that in two different gyms. And I utilized social media in the sense only to take on clients. And through having these kind of systems in place to just acquire enough clients to get by, I've kind of just kept doing that consistently for probably, 4 years now. And I'm at a position where I've got over 1 million followers between social media platforms. And just operate an online personal training academy and written a couple of books. That's about it.
Where's the cash come from for the moment? Sorry to be crude. Is it coming from the app?
Yeah, so in the academy, in the last 3 or 4 years, we've had about 450,000 people go through it. And like that doesn't mean that they've all paid £100. Someone could have paid just £8 for 1 month and left. So we've had hundreds of thousands of people that have come through and they've all kind of upskilled, learned. And it's almost like an online learn how to drive course where people at their own discretion can learn what they need to. And then they're in a position to leave and do their own thing. The book deals have been very kind as far as advances and royalties. We've done over 500,000 copies between the two books. So those two are good. And the royalties tick over. And every time you do a bit of television or a bit of media, you'll sell however many books. After going on Piers Morgan on Good Morning Britain, I think we did about 10,000 hardbacks for 5 minutes work. So those are the main ways. I don't do paid ads. I don't do adverts. I don't do any promotions or collaborations, which allows me to be myself on social media.
Why did you go on Piers Morgan? Did you go on GMB?
Yeah. So it was quite interesting. I knew that there was this kind of media trend where people were tiptoeing around calling people fat. And on social media, I would say, look, if you're fat, or, you know, I'll be like, if you're the size of a house, this is what you need to do. And it's a bit tongue in cheek, but I've never been afraid of saying to fat people that they're fat. So when the kind of call came to go on to Good Morning Britain, I knew exactly what they were going to do. I was like, they're going to try and throw me under the bus, calling Piers or Susanna fat. So I kind of agreed in the email correspondence with the Good Morning Britain producers that I would do that. But then when I got on air, I kind of slide my way around and dodged a few of the questions and threw Joe Wicks under the bus and had a bit of fun. But it was, you know, even Susanna says, oh, do you think Piers is fat? And I said, you know, it's not the first thing I thought when I looked at him. You know, and I said to him that, he goes, what's the secret? Why am I not losing weight? And I said to him, if his dog got fat, he'd probably walk his dog more and feed it less meals. And I don't understand why we should give humans that much of a different kind of set of directions when they want to get in better shape.
What is we'll get onto that in a minute, actually, because that's an interesting point. What is it that makes your app so successful, do you think? I said your brutal honesty is what I'm seeing off your social media, and it's quite nice to have that. It's quite refreshing that you're really not tiptoeing around things, are you? I mean, let's face it, it's sweary, it's blunt, it's go for it. A bit like Goggins, actually, my hero. So, you know, just tell people where it's at. Do you think that's it?
I think that also, it sounds almost big-headed to say that I think I'm quite good at spotting trends, narratives, and topics. So I don't think that growing my social media is really going to be a problem over the next, say, 5 years. So as I have such an incredible churn rate of people that come across me, I am very vested in just working with people and I'm happy to see them leave. And with the app, the whole idea is that I always see consumers on one side, anyone that needs help with their diet. The principles sit on the other side. So for fat loss being a calorie deficit, and every one of my competitors is trying to create a method in the middle. And a lot of their methods are blocking the consumer from the principle. It's dressing it up as keto, as 5-2, as fasting, or whatever it is, so that the consumer can never quite fully grasp or get to arm's length. They're being kept at arm's length like an adult with a child that's trying to swing punches. And because of that, I like to create a system that replaces all the methods or puts them in bed with the principle so they don't have to worry. And when people understand that principle, they can choose whatever method they like because they understand how it works.
Andy Peters, who's quite ripped, said to me once, I said, how you get it like that? He goes, all abs are created in the kitchen, Tim. Is that your theory on this, that diet is much... Actually, what's his name? Bear Grylls has done a book as well, hasn't he? Where he initially said he thought it was 80% exercise, 20% diet. Now he thinks it's the other way around. I might have made up those stats, by the way, but it's something like that. But is that how you feel? It's more calories about the diet than it is the exercise?
Yeah, so do you know what? Andy Peters and I, we train in the same gym, and I bumped into him the other day. He's a big boy. He's pretty small. And, yeah. You know, I've seen him on TV over the years. And he's very well trained. So I always say to people, like, imagine you have a switchboard in front of you and you're in control of so many different components of your training. Now, ultimately, everyone should be doing the same training modality here on in. You're probably, it sounds depressing, going to rotate the same 20 exercises or 25 exercises and the same 15 or 20 meals forever. Like, people don't like hearing that, but people do eat the same meals on rotation. And, you know, you're probably going to go from a squat to a split squat to a lunge over periods of, say, 8, 10, 12-week training periods or whatever. And in each workout, you're going to always be striving to progress. I get my clients to do something called an RPE, called a rate of perceived exertion, which means every time they finish a set, they ask themselves how hard it was out of 10. And if that gets to a 7 or below, they look to progress with either adding reps or adding weight. Now, all of these different areas of the switchboard, you're going to be trying to maximize your protein, maximize your sleep, hit a good step count, seek progressive overload in the gym using these systems. Then to one side, we then have total calories. If you have an athlete who now, or a person or a housewife, lawyer, whatever, that wants to get in shape or lean up or drop body fat, the only switch on the switchboard we're going to manipulate is calories down. And we're going to keep the protein notch high because protein is a key player in fat loss and in muscle growth. In muscle growth, it's essential to ensure that we've got amino acids in circulation. But in fat loss, it's a key player in keeping people full, and it burns. We lose most calories in digesting it. So we just bring back that dial on net calories, and that is quite simply it. Everything else remains the same. And often we have to say to people, there are no fat loss workouts. There are no finishers, burners, intensities, any of this. And if you look at people across the whole, when they want to lose weight, that's the only thing they need to manipulate. Whether or not that fits into a split of 80% diet or exercise or whatever, unfortunately, we can't escape the fact that it is a calorie manipulation. And byproduct is we are probably going to manipulate carbohydrates and fats, the two energy macronutrients, to come down to create that deficit.
How successful are you with your clients? I mean, what's their success rate?
Do you know what? This is an interesting question because a lot of the times that I train people on the floor, people would come in and honestly, they'd go, I want this, I want this. And I would have to say, you don't. You know, people go, oh, James, I want to be ripped. And I'd have to say to them, okay, tell me about yourself. I'm married, got two kids. You know, I walk the dogs every day. I love a gin and tonic with my husband when he comes home from work. And I'm like, cool, your life sounds great. I don't think that me getting you a six pack is going to make your life better. I actually think it's going to make your life worse. And they're like, what do you mean by that? And I'm like, well, okay, this calorie manipulation is going to mean that something's going to have to give. And I'll be honest, that the majority of people that come to me striving for that, I say to them, this is going to make your life worse, not better. You think that a six pack or abs is going to make you happy, but you are naive to the amount of happiness we're going to have to give up in obtaining that. So often I say to people, right, how about this? We create a program full of exercises you like. We seek marginal gains with that week on week. Now, if someone was very overweight, I'd say, let's get you down to a weight you feel happy at. It wasn't the original weight they wanted to get to. They might have wanted to lose 15 kilograms. We might lose them 10 and they go, I'm still having my gin tonics. My training is awesome. I'm noticing that I'm getting stronger. I'm happy where I'm at. And for other people that have come to me wanting huge fitness goals or whatever, they actually just enjoy the fact that following a program and the fact that they train four times a week makes them feel better. And I had clients where, I'll be honest, they weren't making any progress as far as fat loss, weight loss. The money was still coming in each week. And I'd say to them, like, what's going on here? And they were like, you know what? I'm happy. I feel active. I feel better in myself. I probably wobble a bit less. I feel more trained. I've got a holiday coming up in 3 months. Let's restrict calories for the 2 months beforehand. And rather than me sitting here and go, yeah, everyone's successful, everyone's great, I'd rather say that I've actually probably changed a lot of people's goals from what they initially walked in with and given them probably a better set of values where, you know, it seems quite sad to me that so many people, when I explain to them that switchboard of their training and nutrition, that all we're going to do is reduce calories, because reducing calories makes your life worse. There's objectively speaking, it's why overweight people struggle, and it's why people in good shape struggle to go from good to great. Something has to give. And improving your health or reducing the statistical chances of bad things happening is a great motivator. But for the rest of people that don't need that kind of motivation to really get control of their life, they're the ones that need better goals.
What mistakes do you think PTs make? I watch a lot. I go to gyms a lot. I go to two different gyms, and I watch a lot of PTs. And I just sometimes think that what you're doing, they're getting nothing out of that. Like, half the time they're talking. You've got like an hour session or half an hour session with a PT and you're talking. You're like, shut the fuck up and get do some exercise. Do you know what I mean? But what do you think? What do you think the mistakes are that PTs make?
On for hours. Like, first of all, you see them doing like, you know, one arm lateral raise to the side. You're working the deltoid, you're working a shoulder muscle that's so small. They're taking a minute rest in between, doing four sets. 15 minutes has gone by and your right shoulder muscle has done 40 movements that weren't that difficult. And I completely agree. A kind of theory I have is one that I spoke with Amy about called the swimmer's body illusion, where people could get into swimming because they want to look like swimmers. But swimmers don't look the way they do because they swim. They swim because of the way they look. Mm. And the same with professional rugby players. Everyone says to them, you're big and broad because you play rugby, but I disagree. They play rugby because they're big and broad. And if you get a selection of a school year of 100 boys, you get them all to play rugby, which you do. The big, bulky guys that have dense bones, higher body weight, and, you know, muscle fibers that could make them very good athletes will fall into rugby. And the ones who are more agile, fast, and speedy will be playing football. And their sports almost pick them. I loved football when I grew up, but I wasn't good at it. My body, I'm not built like a footballer. I was generally just shit at it. So getting back to the point is, most personal trainers have ended up in their gym, in their profession, because they fucking look good. Whether it's narcissism, whether it's obsession, whether it's eating disorders. And a lot of eating disorders exist within the fitness industry. So many people forget that. A lot of people's idols and peers on Instagram have been in a continual deficit. They're getting fucking 10 grand a month from Gymshark, right? 10 grand a month puts you in a nice flat. And every time you're hungry and you look at the flat you're living in and going, I won't be able to afford this if I eat the amount of food I want to eat, right? So we've got all these people with all this fucking pressure to look a certain way. It doesn't mean they have empathy, compassion, intelligence, or an understanding of basic programming. And unfortunately, you get people down to a low enough body fat percentage, they will look muscular. There's nothing else there. So we've got these people in gyms, irrespective of the causation of why they're in good shape, and they are funneled. Their mates go, oh, you should, well, they haven't got many mates, many of them. They get funneled into this, you should be a personal trainer. And it's become more about how the person looks than what the person can do. And if anyone doesn't believe me, go into a commercial gym and look at the PT board. They have every opportunity to, you know, win over someone walking by to become their client. 80% of them got their fucking top off. They are marketing how they look, not who they are. And when I worked in a commercial gym, I didn't put a blurb. Everyone's like, oh, I'm Andy, I swam for County. No one fucking cares. I'm John, I've done S&C. No one cares. I said, if you need help with fat loss, drop me a text or an email. That's all it said online. And it's such an industry now where you have got fucking idiots that don't know what they're doing, that are just selling their own workouts and their own diets to people that come in. And it's no wonder there's a churn rate with clients and with personal trainers.
Well, I want to get onto diet in a minute, but there's a psychological element to the exercise, isn't there? I tried for a while to do weight training and spent all my life playing football and doing stuff like that. I tried to do weight training and I found the thing just so mind-numbingly boring, trying to do a bench press. And I was watching all the other dudes in the gym and they're really getting off on it, and good on them, and they were doing those things, you know, like those lateral lifts and all that sort of stuff, isolating muscles, and I just felt like it didn't feel mentally right for me not to have all the muscles working together. As soon as I jump in a pool, which I've done today, or I go on a run, or I've got a thing called a VersaClimber, so you can see it behind me there, you know, those sort of things, I feel like the whole body's working as one, and I get off on that, and I feel like, oh, where are my gains, you know, can I get the time down, can I do that? It's really psychological, isn't it? But I did realize when I was doing the bench pressing and stuff, you seem to burn a lot of calories, you seem to lose a lot of fat for some reason.
So I always get people to move away from the notion that they're exercising to burn calories. I would say that's with the amount of manipulation we can do with calories, someone goes, oh, you should do spinning, it's great for fat loss, or it's great for burning calories. It's fucking shit. You're cycling on a brake with a fucking brake, cycling on a bike with the brakes on. But 70% of people, they hate it. So I don't care how many calories it burns. So when I say to people, I'm like, do something you enjoy. And you saying that you enjoy swimming more than weights means that swimming has trumped weights in the program that I would give you, purely through enjoyment, because I need you to do this for a long time. I agree with the weights being relatively numbing. And that's, again, why I actually prefer training people online. I say, go to the gym, listen to your own music, listen to your own podcast that you want to, Joe Rogan, James Smith,
Tim Lovejoy,
whatever, yeah. And do that whilst you do the numbing exercise. What you don't need is me sitting next to you going, good weekend. Yeah. How was Timmy's play? Good, was it? You know, like this fucking shit, small talk. So there's all these kind of different things that people like. And again, I actually am very happy for my clients to say they do 12 weeks, 24 weeks, whatever it is. A lot of them now end up going to CrossFit, Jiu-Jitsu. They start one of my friends' Olympic weightlifting programs. It's more like a foundation for people, because once they lose 5 kilograms and they get their strength up and they can bench, squat and deadlift without their back hurting, they feel a lot more physically ready to move on. They're very intimidated by CrossFit. They're very intimidated by Jiu-Jitsu. They're very intimidated by, you know, changing rooms to go swimming. So for me, it's me saying, here's resistance training, use it for a while, move on and try something else and branch out. And then it just becomes like almost the backbone to their regime. Even when I do jiu-jitsu 7 times a week, I need to have 2 resistance training sessions in there to help me offset injury, for instance.
Okay, so I bought some Rascal trunks for the summer. I need to get ripped. I need to get 0% body fat. Actually, some of the swimwear you wear is appalling. I'm sorry, man. You spent far too much time in Australia. They're really small. is that what they're wearing down in Aussie at the moment?
Yeah, they actually mock people for wearing board shorts. So the culture there is like, you know, oh, that's embarrassing. Like, ooh, wearing board shorts, oh, what's he hiding? It started off as banter, actually. I was in the Great Barrier Reef and a mate of mine had Speedos. I thought this would be funny. And after swimming in them, you get out and putting on shorts makes you feel like you're swimming in a t-shirt or a hoodie. Like, there's too much going on here. And also, quite an interesting point. Like, even now, I have a mustache, right?
Yeah.
And everyone's like, why the hell have you got a mustache? Why do you wear these stupid sunglasses and the budgies? And it's a bit of banter. It's a bit of fun. And we spoke a little bit offline before we came on. Everyone is playing the majority. Everyone wants the majority of, you know, wokeism or culture or politics, whatever it is. And everyone's forgotten there are the outliers, the 20% of people. So when I wear the budgie smugglers, I wore them to a boat party and a girl said to me, you'd be so attractive if you didn't wear those. And I was like, okay. But there's probably going to be a small percentage of women that find that funny and go, fucking hell, I want to go for a gin and tonic with that guy, not with these boring guys over here. And there's a small percentage of women that are really attracted to mustaches, right? And no guy would ever dream about having a tash because they think it looks stupid, or, you know, they'll make up some connotation about it. But then I've even seen it on Hinge apps. Women say, I'm weirdly attracted to mustaches. So playing the percentage of women, no one else is going for those women. There's no competition there. And the same reason, like swearing on social media, no one swears on social media or says something or anything outlandish because they're worried about the majority. They're forgetting there is a minority of people that go, this guy just called someone fat. He's not afraid to talk about subjects that, you know, this is my kind of guy. And the swimwear is kind of like an encapsulation of not taking life too seriously and going for only the people that are in the same boat. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like a bit of fun on the side. And when we go to Sail Week in Croatia or a club in Dubai or Ibiza, if you've got eight lads in budgie smugglers, when girls come into the club, they know where the party's at. They're not looking at the guys in the board shorts with the Rolexes.
Yeah, good point. I like your way of thinking. I do like it. All right, listen, I promise we're going to get on to diet in a minute, but just quickly on Australia, you said it was like a toxic environment towards PT and stuff. What, you live there now, don't you? You're based there.
I mean,
at the moment, but you're based there normally.
Yeah, I like to split my time up all in Australia apart from May to October in the UK when it's a bit warm. They have tall poppy syndrome there. So whenever you try and excel at anything, the tallest poppy is the first to be cut down because they want to keep everything uniform. So the culture there really doesn't support ambition. As far as Australia's a very cruisy country, they've got everything they need. They're in permanent holiday mode. And there just wasn't the fitness industry there. It just feels toxic. There's a lot of lip fillers, Botox, anabolic steroids, and it's very fake. It's very Instagram-y, it's very angles, it's very Photoshop. And I didn't really like it. I thought it was going to be the pinnacle of good service, good personal training, but it was a bit of a disappointment when I got there.
We have tall poppy syndrome over here. I always say to people, the more famous I got, the more criticism I got. And, you know, I can tell when I'm popular because I get absolutely hammered online. There's a lot of people who don't like it. And sadly, negative people and negative connotations towards yourself are the ones that you end up seeing, don't you, quite a lot. So we do have that. I'm sure you must get it a lot. People wanting to cancel you, or not cancel you, but they must hate you because you're successful at what you do.
Yes. And do you know what? This has happened through history for like thousands of years before social media.
Yeah, even Jesus. Like Jesus, he was put on a cross.
Even like Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, all these people that came up with these amazing quotes to change thinking and philosophy. They had haters and they had people that wanted to kind of ruin them. And it's this phenomenon in culture and society is the way you get it. And it's crazy the weight. You could read 100 book reviews, the one bad one stays with you. And you can't, and the more you try and suppress it, the more it stays there. But ultimately, I can only care about the opinions of people that are going to buy a book, come to an event. And if someone's not literally slipping off the edge of their seat to join my academy or be a part of what I do, then it's a bit like taking advice or, you know, taking criticisms from someone you would never go to for advice.
James, I was reading about, I'm going to say this name, but I don't know how to pronounce it, Ignaz Semmelweis. Do you know that bloke? He was the one who said, you know what, I think he was doing a lot with childbirth and stuff, and he was going, you know what, he was a doctor, I think we should be washing our hands because there's germs on our hands. His peers were so offended, other doctors, that he thought they should wash their hands. He thought he was nuts. They eventually put him in a loony bin. They put him in a loony asylum because they said he was nuts because he was talking about these little things they couldn't see on the hands. Isn't that incredible? So, yeah, I was hungry and bloke. So there you go. Right, let's go on to the diet then. So whenever you go onto your app or you go onto anything to do with you, immediately there comes a calculator. You put in your age, you put in your weight, and then it tells you the calories and the protein you need to eat to lose weight. Explain the theory behind it before we get into it.
So for a start, I like to give people a base amount of calories to start with. And usually one of three things will happen. One, nothing happens. Let's say I've estimated a certain amount of calories. The certain amount of calories is based off their height, their age, and their weight. And this is literally assuming the average amount of mass and then how much they move. So they're told to, I'm lightly active, very active, whatever. So you've got a certain amount of mass times an activity level. It's a ballpark figure. And I say that to people like, this may not work. 2 weeks in, James, I've not lost any fat. Cool. That number is probably a bit too high for your goal. Nothing lost. Second thing, they lose a little bit of fat. Cool. That's probably a great amount of calories for you. Three, James, I've lost a lot of weight, but I'm very hungry, very irritable, and my sleep isn't good. Hey, do you know what? That number is probably too low. And you can amend that 2-3 weeks in and, you know, try and find this kind of sweet spot. With the total calories, that's the most important. But the protein element is the second most important. And I don't set the protein too high because a lot of people come into this calculator, they're very new to this idea of tracking. And it's not about saying to them, you must hit that amount. It's just making them aware of where they are and where I would like them to be. and getting them to be understanding of the fact that they're optimizing the process by eating more protein. The protein is going to support them in recovery, fill them up, and they're also going to lose more calories from protein than any other macronutrient. That puts no focus on food quality in the onset. But let's say, like, you got a leak in your kitchen. I always say, let's address the leak before we clean up. Let's address the leak, because if we focus too much on food quality and getting your vegetables and your fiber and your salt and all these things, we can start clearing up the kitchen naive to the fact the leak has not been addressed. And we're just going to be in this, you know, vicious loop of trying to get on top of things. So that's really the initial steps that they have in place when they start.
Oh, have you seen this work on everyone?
What do you mean by that question?
Has everyone you've done it with, I mean, obviously you don't know everyone on the app, but everyone you've done it with personally, has it worked, the calorie protein combination to
lose weight? So some people don't like tracking, and we say, okay, other tools at your disposal, reducing meal frequency, working on portion sizing. You've got people with pre-existing eating disorders who shouldn't be tracking. We have like a little disclaimer for them. You've got other people with pre-existing conditions, such as polycystic ovary syndrome. But even then, when they calculate it, they come back, they go, James, I've got polycystic ovary syndrome. I don't think this number is going to work. I say, do you know what? Me neither. But it is a case of getting them to reduce slowly until they see results. Women who are perimenopausal or menopausal, it's the fact that they are burning less calories than they think. It's not the fact that a calorie deficit isn't working. It's the fact they think they're in one and they're not. And someone with a thyroid disorder, all of these kind of conditions, they go, a calorie deficit doesn't work for me. And we have to say to them, no, you've calculated a calorie deficit based off a very blunt algorithm, and your condition brings you beneath that. And it sounds sad to say, but for some people, if fat loss is imperative to the, you know, we're looking at overweight and obese people, they need to keep reducing net calories until it starts working.
Explain the protein thing. What sort of protein do you need? Does it have to be animal protein?
So protein in general, we say quite blasé, any protein. For animal protein is always going to be superior in my eyes. If people wish to have a vegan or vegetarian diet and get protein from other sources, they will need to consume more protein. So even more than what an meat eater would, for instance. And often those feedings from an individual basis also have to contain more protein as well. Without making it a science lesson, you need a certain amount of constituent amino acids to form a protein. Now, one of them is responsible for kickstarting muscle building. It's called leucine. And leucine is not in abundance in plant-based proteins as much as it is with animal-based protein. So say I say to you, you need 120 grams of protein a day. I'd like you to get that over, you know, four or five feedings of 25 to 30 grams of protein. I would then have to say to someone who was a vegetarian or vegan, oh, I'm actually going to need you to consume more net protein and have more per sitting to make sure that we hit that. And this again is optimization. We say to people, this is your best case scenario. We want people to aim for that. You know, if you're a football coach, you're going to say, right, let's go out, let's try and score six goals. Because if they score three, they're probably going to win. But we always need to set a benchmark at the top. You need to set that as high as you can. The calculator determines 1.5 to 2 grams per kilogram. Now, again, this is based off lean mass. But for most people, even if they base it off their total mass, that is a considerable amount of protein. The reason it's got a massive satiety index, so for fat loss, protein will fill you up a lot. On top of that, about 30% of the calories in protein are lost in digestion. Mm. We have to produce heat to digest it. So when you accumulate all these things together, you have a very solid argument that protein is going to be a key beneficiary out of the macronutrients when looking for.
But you need it for it to work. For to lose weight, you need to make a percentage of your diet, or can you just cut calories?
No, you could just cut calories. You could, you know, quite easily have subpar amounts of protein or even no protein. If people wanted to just eat cereal for the next 2 months, if they did it in a deficit, they would lose considerable amounts of weight. However, when protein is not in the diet or being consumed, the body still has requirements for amino acids. And if it cannot take them from the diet, it will steal it from existing tissue, which is where we see people lose muscle mass. So in essence, it's not just that the muscle is not being trained, it's the body clawing back amino acids that it needs.
Can I pick up on something you just said there? I like experimenting. I told you this. I've tried so many different diets, the keto, the intermittent fasting, carnivore. I tried for 2 weeks. That's hard work eating meat. Mentally, it's hard work to eat just eat meat every meal. Jesus Christ. I don't know how people do that one. I tried vegetarianism. I was starving all the time. And I ended up, I couldn't help myself, but just kept eating carbs because I was so hungry that I can't. And look, sorry if you're vegetarian here. I did it probably badly, but I was trying to eat beans and things like that, but I just was always hungry. And I don't know whether it was my body trying to adjust or whatever, but you just said there about protein being a making you feel full up. Is that what you said?
Yeah, it's the highest in satiety. So when people are, you know, James, I'm hitting my calories, but I'm feeling hungry all the time. Vegetables do their part, but like you say, you almost feel a little bit empty. Although your stomach's full from like a psychological basis, you feel a bit empty, but protein is one that we include it in every meal, not just for the biological side, but it fills people up.
Right. Okay. Now, the thing, whenever I listen to, like I listen to you on Amy, this is the last time she's getting a plug for a podcast. When I listen to you on Amy's and stuff, the thing I'm always crying out is, how do you bloody count calories? How do you actually go about doing this? Because it just seems so hard. You get a meal and say, today I had a salad. How the hell do I work out? You know, I had spinach salad. How do I work out what the hell's going on there? What are the calories of it? Where's the protein? Blah, blah, blah. I just can't get my head around how to do it. Is it literally sitting there with scales constantly?
So I always compare it to using tracing paper at school. When you have kids and you say, right, we want to improve an existing habit you have, we're going to give you a bit of tracing paper. You're going to use the line sheet underneath. I'm going to improve your habits so that we can take away the tracing paper and your habits have improved. Now, people are going to pick up at different amounts, but I would never say to anyone to weigh a salad. And I'd say that if you took scales to a meal, you're a sociopath. Like, you know, that is way beyond it.
Hey, I've done it when I went on the Tim Spector one, the diet thing, which I'll tell you about later, but go on.
I personally think that is more unhealthy than even being overweight or obese. And so for people and for myself, when I start to cook, you know, I'll scan on a packet of mince. I'll scan on Uncle Ben's spicy rice. Vegetables, I'm like, nah, they'll be all right, you know, unless I'm putting potatoes in or something like that. When I had to make weight for a jiu-jitsu competition, something as simple as just popping a bowl on a small food scale and saying to myself, I'm only going to have 250 grams of cereal. So I know how much to put in the bowl, because 500 calories and 800 calories of cereal don't look too different. And then it gave me peace of mind that I had my mince, I had my vegetables, I had my cereal. I knew that I had about 1,000 calories for dinner every night. And then when it came to dinner and my housemates were cooking or someone had cooked for me or I'm dating a girl, I just left it there. And when I got there and I sat with all the food in front, I had a basic understanding of what 1,000 calories was. And if someone was to say, oh, do you want another burger? In my mind, I wasn't like, yeah, let's weigh the fucker. I was like, nah, I've only got 1,000 calories. I've had a good day of eating. So it's just about giving people these systems. Or, you know, if someone was to always leave 1,000 calories for the evening when they're eating with their partner, prep chicken and Caesar baguette, you know, 450 calories, cool. Can of Coke Zero, cool. Rice cakes from Pret, 250 calories. Like, I remember those things so that I always have that buffer. So people can make it fit however they like. But the best part of it is you then have belief in what you're doing. And you go, right, I actually feel like I want to have a McDonald's. I haven't had McDonald's in ages. I've just had a whiff. If someone's as they've walked past me, I wonder how much a Big Mac is. Cool. You look at the Big Mac, you're like, oh, 450 calories. It's not far off, you know, that massive bowl of cereal I was going to have. On a psychological basis, what's going to make me feel better today? And the fact that they could order that, they might have usually just thought, fuck it, I'm throwing the diet away. I'm having a pizza, takeaway, whatever. But the fact that they've ordered a single Big Mac and a Coke Zero from McDonald's at 3 p.m. on a Thursday afternoon and made it work is the kind of magical part of it. And that's where the power of it comes in. It's almost like a belief system, or people log bacon for the first time and go, why has this got so many calories in? Or salmon, why has this got so many calories in? Or almonds or nut butters. For some reason, people think peanut butter is a fucking fitness food. But the amount of calories that are in it, there's like a better deal. And I always say to people, when scanning foods, don't think of it like you're in the fucking Matrix. Just ask yourself, is that a good deal? You know, eating a whole avocado, I'm sure it's got all the vitamin K in the fucking world, but that's 300 calories. Have half, put another half back in the fridge and get 150 calories from a fucking protein bar, Kit Kat, or your favorite fruit pastels from back in the day, because it has to work. There have to be hedonic foods in there. And if we can alleviate a little bit of that kind of negative thought process towards these hedonic foods, people are going to have a better time of dieting.
What does that mean, that word, hedonic foods?
Hedonic, like they're pleasurable, they excite us. Like, so all the foods that we're told not to eat have some basis of hedonism, like bakeries. Okay. The way they present their pastries at the front counter, Prep do this as well. It's all a part of putting these in front. They don't put bottled water at the front when you're at the checkout. They put hedonic foods.
I must apologize. I've signed up to your app to have a look around, but I haven't actually gone right in and put the cash down yet. So do you give the calorific values of food there, or where can people start finding them out? Where is the, apart from the label on a bit of plastic, but if you're actually going into a shop and buying an avocado, how the hell do you find out what roughly the calorific value of it is, or a carrot or whatever?
So MyFitnessPal, probably the industry leader. It's owned by Under Armour. It's a free app for people to use. And until I can create something that's better than MyFitnessPal, I'm just going to tell them to use that app. And most of the time, use barcodes. So most foods have got barcodes on them. Even a bag of carrots has got barcodes on. And then the barcode will give you a breakdown of, are you having one serving or are you having the full weight of the packet? Now, every supermarket chain, Nando's especially, is great to put in there. You're like, oh, I'm having a double chicken pita wrap. Macho peas and peri chips. It's all in there and it's like verified as well. So again, let's say I've got someone who really desperate to lose weight, going for Nando's with their workmates on the night. I'll say to them, log what you're going to have tonight, make the decision now. And now you've got an allowance of calories, fill your boots throughout the day. They can use that, go over some days, come down others, get weekly amounts of calories, because net calories, I say to people to get their day's calorie times it by 7. Mm-hmm. Because similar to your payslip, it doesn't matter how you spend it. As long as you balance the books before your next payslip, you're fine. And for most people, you are going to have a lot more on weekends and a lot less during the week. And if people are getting new to it, I say start on Friday, have your normal weekend. Because a lot of overweight people go, oh, 2,200 calories seems like a lot, James.
Hold on, but you're saying that over a 7-day period, you can do high and low. Like, you think that?
Yeah, so let's say I've got a hypothetical person called Trisha, put her on 2,200 calories for fat loss. She goes, fucking hell, James, looks like a lot of calories. I go, all right, Trish, log your fucking weekend, start on a Friday. She has a bottle of wine with her husband, goes out for a nice steak, comes back. She ends up doing 3,000-4,000 calories each day, which is normal for a weekend. She's now only left with 1,400 a day for the week. And she goes, oh, this feels a bit restrictive. I go, yeah, because you enjoyed your food at the weekend. But the same way with money, most people are very frugal throughout the week. They get on the tube. They're not getting Ubers because they're going to save a bit of money. Yeah, then they go out for dinner and buy a fucking big round. Everyone drinks around me. If you look to people's Monzo spending habits, Monday to Friday, Saturday to Sunday, considering a lot of financial expenses on food and drink, you can see this correlation to peaks and troughs where you've got the 5-2 diet where you reduce calories on 2 days. And you eat normally on 5. I think fuck that around, go the other way, have very sensible calories for 5 and then pig out on 2.
Yeah, I suppose the one thing you've got to be wary of, and I can see this would happen to me, is that I would start weighing and counting calories. I eat just quite a healthy diet. I assume a healthy diet. And I eat lots of variety because I've been on these sort of trials and stuff. And talk a lot about gut health, and I've done that on here, and that's all about variety. But I could see myself going, if I just eat chicken and broccoli every day, and then I would just do all my calories. And so I could just simplify the shit out of my diet and become obsessive about it. And I could see that me doing that, because that's how my brain works, to try and win by getting less calories every week, which is how I work. So I suppose there's a little bit of a problem with that when you start counting calories too much.
Well, I only ever put people in a perceived 15% deficit, which isn't a huge amount. It's only ever 15%. And if people, it's at their discretion if they want to go bigger or smaller or whatever. But what happens after a while is people have to make habitual changes to fit that number. And they might go from an egg and bacon BAP on the way to work to having yogurt with some blueberries in. And then when it comes to lunch, they might have no dressing with something that they order at their favorite food place. And when they get to dinner, you know, Wagamama's katsu chicken is fucking 1,200 to 1,300 calories in one dish.
I love that stuff.
Chicken ramen is 550.
Wow.
Now I know that. I haven't logged in about 3 or 6 months. When I go to Wagamama's, I no longer have the katsu because I can have the ramen, the bang bang cauliflower, and the chili squid for the same amount of calories. I'm a changed person forever. And every time I see someone having the fucking katsu chicken, I'm there going, you sure, mate? You sure, mate? You're right, and Gyoza, are you fucking mental?
It's definitely a lifestyle change, isn't it? I always say this with everything, and it's really easy. In the 90s when I decided to go out every night and get hammered, and my diet and fitness wasn't the great. It took an absolute lifestyle change to change that, because when I was hungover, I wanted calorific food. I was fine because I was young and it was great. I could lose the weight quickly, but to lose the weight, I had to change my mindset. I couldn't go drinking every night. I had to start eating sensibly, and it is a lifestyle, isn't it? You can't go out every night drinking. You can't sit and have a bottle of wine every night and then have a healthy life. It just doesn't equate, does it?
Yeah, it's one of those things where those habits, like I mentioned before, those slight changes, when you take away tracking, they're probably going to become accustomed to their yogurt and blueberries. Yeah. They're going to become accustomed to their changes. Now, with drinking, I've always said to people, like, you know, balance is important, and booze itself, I don't think, is bad for muscle growth objectively, but it's bad for your sleep. It's bad for your recovery. It's bad for your mood. It can make you, you know, just feel shit, which isn't going to benefit it. I say to people, you know, either pick your battles or even just commit to knocking it on the head for a month or 2 months, because what I feel like I'm providing for people is just the framework to better their position or to put them onto a better trajectory, because a trajectory change doesn't have to be that big. Because if you change someone's direction only a little bit over enough time, that equates to a completely different destination. And, you know, drinking habits is one that for myself, especially now I get a bit older, it makes me feel terrible.
Well, your body goes into survival mode, doesn't it? Because it's panicking a bit. It doesn't know what's going on. So it wants to get calories on. Every time your body panics, it wants to get calories on board, doesn't it? Because it's a survival thing. Is that right?
I think it's more of a psychological, and I think more of a evolutionary response system. So, you know, I always think of human beings being very primitive. Like even now where, you know, guys get drunk and just want to have sex, I'm like, that's quite normal. You know, that's what primitive man's been doing for a long time. Go out, scavenge for women and for food. And the reward systems that would have to be in place in you know, human beings to survive for so long would surround reward systems for sex and reward systems for food. They're two things that are essential for us to go from a single cell organism to 9 billion fucking people. Yeah. And it, you know, people, can they ever imagine a prehistoric man sat there, discovers a bush of berries and only eats half? I'm trying, I'm going away in a few months. I want to stay lean. Of course he's not. He's going to gouge on every fucking berry that's there.
All right, I'm going to get into that in just a minute's time, but just quickly, two things. Dr. Mir Krieger, by the way, one of the leading sleep guys in the world, he was on this podcast and he said, by the way, I drink. I don't drink too much, but I drink. And he said, treat alcohol like caffeine. Just don't do it at night. And I thought, just like get pissed during the day. That's the idea. And it just amused me that, because he says it's terrible for your sleep, alcohol. But the other thing I wanted to quickly mention before we go on to talk about abundance of food is supplements. I've had quite a lot of professors and doctors of things come on here, and most of them think supplements are crap. You might as well flush them down the toilet. But in the gym, there's so many supplements, because you've got all your sort of vitamins and stuff, which like people like to take, but you've also got whey protein and all those sort of things. How do you, so many guys, I see huge fat guys sitting, drinking those drinks after the thing. I think, Jesus, I reckon they're calorific. I don't know, but they look it to me that these great big protein drinks, they're shoving down them at the end of a training session. What do you think about those things?
So I think that I agree that the majority of supplements are a waste of time. Whey protein, that is, you know, anyone listening, it's a waste product in the cheese making process. So whey protein used to be very cheap and now it's mass marketed because it has such a fantastic profile for a protein. It's almost more of a superfood than anything else. It's not that expensive. It doesn't need to be cooked. It doesn't need to be refrigerated. just got to add fucking water and shake it. And you've got one of the best foods that's out there. So for a lot of people looking to supplement their diet, or people that don't like meat, vegetarians, it's literally a fucking savior. And if your 17-year-old boy wants to, you know, hit the gym, that protein shake probably makes him feel 20% more manly. So, you know, absolutely smash those there. I'm gym now, I'm Bulk Hogan or whatever. So with the whey protein, I think that's great. And again, I'd love to see it being used in hospitals when people come out of surgery. Protein and calories are essential for people to heal. They take people grapes in hospital. They take them like, oh, it's some crisps or whatever. Like, that would improve people's healing times post-operative for tenfold. But anyway, that's a whole nother conversation. Creatine is another interesting one. We produce creatine naturally, but supplementing creatine will put more creatine into your system than any meat eater. You'd have to eat about 2 kilograms of red meat a day just to get the same amount of creatine that people supplement in powder form. Now, creatine's been studied for about 25 years. It will benefit your ability to train. It will benefit your performance. It will benefit your recovery. It will allow you to store and uptake more energy in muscles, which then can make them look bigger. It will make you a bit heavier. But now we're starting to see creatine in the realms of concussion, Alzheimer's, a lot of cognitive kind of benefits to creatine. Because creatine plays a big role in producing energy, full stop, it's now people are kind of tying it into studies with helping people as far as their cognitive ability, improving thinking skills when sleep deprived. So creatine's a very very exciting and not expensive supplement. So you got creatine, you got your protein. Those are it. Everything else across the supplement board, I think, are pretty much a waste of time. I mean, I'm quite interested by nootropics.
But the concentration. Do the creatine, is it calorific?
No. Or it may be trace calories. It's not like a energy macronutrient.
Have you, as soon as I said you were coming on my podcast, a mate of mine who's a weight trainer said, can you ask him if he's ever tried steroids, ever given it a go and see what he thinks about it?
Yeah, so about 2-3 times I've done steroid cycles in my earlier 20s. Really interesting topic. So you can buy testosterone in oil form from any big guy at your gym. It's not very expensive. Probably costs you less than your protein and creatine would. Once you have this oil-based substance, it's best to inject it, safer technically than taking it orally. So you can take tablets oral, very toxic for your liver to break down. Then injecting is safer because you kind of get it straight into your system. There are loads of videos. So I injected when I took steroids. You do it in your bum. Now, it's not the proudest moment of my life because I was living at home with my parents. So I'm hiding needles from them. 12-week cycle, amazing. You feel like a dog with two dicks. Performance goes up. Muscle mass goes up. Mood, it feels better because you've got more testosterone. And especially for guys who are a little bit older, after the age of 30, a man's natural production of testosterone declines by about 1% a year. And so for a lot of people, it makes them feel good. It makes them feel like they got their je ne sais quoi back. But then there are a lot of complications when you finish that 12 weeks. So in a nutshell, if I was to do like a 2-minute TED talk, when you take a lot of exogenous testosterone, your body no longer needs to produce it, which means your testicles go into atrophy. So they stop producing testosterone. Some people can go around that, but your nuts shrink. So they become like grapes. And at the time, I remember losing my testicles inside me when I was having sex with my girlfriend and getting very concerned. They come back, but that's why you're limited to a 12-week cycle, because if you do any more, you run the risk of atrophying so hard you don't come back fully. Once you finish your cycle, this is where men need to listen. You have to know what you're doing. And I'm lucky, I didn't know that much about what I was doing. You can have issues with getting your penis hard, you get issues with hair loss, you can get issues with breast tissue. So you have to go on to a myriad of drugs when you come off. Tamoxifen, which is a breast cancer drug. Pregnol, which they give to boys when their balls don't drop. You're like a pharmacy when you finish. Now, I was incredibly fortunate. No hair loss, no breast tissue. I enjoyed the 2 cycles, but the 3rd one I went on, I genuinely didn't feel good. Blood pressure was fucked. Water retention in the face. It was a little bit scary for me, actually. And no one on steroids tells you the lull you have afterwards. no matter how hard you're working, you lose muscle, you lose strength, you lose size, and your mood takes a hit because of it. There are so many psychological and physiological implications of steroid use that are not discussed. It is a one-sided bias argument of people that have gained loads of muscle. And yeah, to people out there that are considering it, unless you're going to make a living for it and you can afford to have a doctor, like, you know, in my personal opinion, The Rock. No man in history has been more muscular at 30 than 20, than 40 than 30, than 50 than 40. No man in history. So unless Dwayne Johnson is the most fortunate person in the world, he's on steroids. Most people that play movie roles are taking anabolic steroids, but they've got doctors, practitioners, experts, they're having their lipids checked. And unfortunately, I would say testosterone is recreationally used by people with a poor understanding of the effects, and guys getting developing breast tissue that's incredibly painful. It's a complex topic.
Just really quickly on this one, because I want to get onto two things here. How many times do you train a week, and how many times do you recommend?
So for me, I train jiu-jitsu probably 6-7 times a week for about an hour to 2 hours a session. But because I've been doing it for a few years, I don't expend huge amounts of calories at training because I'm quite aware of the positions and I can relax here, relax there.
How much do you recommend people listening to this should exercise?
I would say the kind of PG answer is how many times you can, because some people don't have the luxury of training 6 times a week. You've got kids, you've got school runs, you've got nursery. If you can get 2 to 3 workouts in a week, good ones, then that's good.
You do need to rest your body though, don't you?
Yes. And on top of that, one thing that I'd say to people is train towards your goal, whether it's running, whether it's injury prevention, whether it's getting stronger, muscle mass. You can gain muscle in 3 1-hour workouts a week. But when it comes to looking to expend calories, it's very important that people understand that if we were to get a 10-story building to signify the amount of calories we burn in a day, 10-story building, the first 7 floors are calories burnt through not moving. We burn 70% of our calories at rest. This is why there are people in comas losing fat, because you burn a tremendous amount of calories at rest. We then have 3 components on top of that where we burn calories. One floor on top of that would be thermic effective feeding, which is high protein diet. So people quite literally burn more calories eating a high protein diet. There are 2 elements left, which is about 3-3.5 floors. Gym training only accounts for 10%. It only accounts for 1 floor. So 90% of your calories burnt throughout the day are not burnt in the gym. So people need to be really careful not to put too much onus and weight on that. The other 2 floors are something called NEAT, which stands for non-exercise activity thermogenesis. And those 2 floors are calories burnt not in the gym, not in planned exercise. Taking the stairs, standing up, walking, fidgeting, all of these things. We burn a tremendous amount of calories outside the gym. So when we look at the depiction of the 10-story building and that top floor being the amount of calories burnt in the gym, if someone trains every other day, that 10% now becomes 5%. Mm. So people need to appreciate that we burn a depressing amount of calories in the gym compared to everywhere else. And the big component that is overlooked by a lot of people is this NEAT component. Parking your car further from the shops, taking the stairs at every opportunity, walking up the escalator. The compounding effects of moving more outside the gym will far outweigh anything you do in the gym. And that's why we've seen such a prevalence of fitness trackers, Fitbits, Garmins, because people's step counts keeps them accountable to a larger piece of the pie of energy expenditure than gym training ever would. Mm. And that's why people need to understand that, because we've seen in studies that when you reduce calories, especially in females, their NEAT decreases catastrophic amounts. So if I put someone in a 15% deficit and they don't check their step count, women will sit at given opportunities. They'll take the stairs. They won't take the stairs. They'll take the escalator. They'll be in the diet mentality of going, well, I'm eating a salad at lunch. So I'll get in the elevator. And so many people they'll eat less food, but completely diminish that deficit by moving substantially less. So it's a bit of a science lesson, but when looking at the components, people need to be so aware that their movement outside the gym plays a bigger part in energy expenditure than their time in the gym.
This is supposed to be an hour long, but I think I might just have to ruin the format just for this next bit, because I must speak about this because it's important. I think is is that I love all everything you say, by the way. I'm a big fan of it all and I agree with it all. The only thing I would say is that after being on a clinical trial with Tim Spector, he sort of, it was a predict study, and he sort of makes the point that one calorie doesn't equal one calorie for two reasons. One calorie of something doesn't equal one calorie of something else is the sort of theory. Also, one calorie in me of pork doesn't react as one calorie in you, because we're all very different. And Dr. Giles Yeo, who's at Cambridge, he also makes this point that he says the calorie doesn't equal a calorie. And also what Dr. Giles Yeo said, which is fascinating because you sort of said about it earlier, the age of abundance, right? When this is the first time in the last like 50, 60 years in the history of humans, we've got too much food. Every other time, like my grandparents and stuff, were always looking around to try and get calories on board, to try and, you know, like the big meal on Sunday. That's why Sunday roast was so important. It was, they put a lot of calories. That's their cheat meal when they put their calories there. But he says this as well. And the final thing to add to this is, because it's quite a complex thing, is metabolism changes as you get older. When I was a kid, I could just burn everything like that. Now it's really hard. So what's your thoughts on a calorie being a calorie?
So a calorie is a measurement, and I'm pretty sure they use something called a barometer to determine the calorie content of something. So as far as clinical practice and, you know, experimentation, that can't really be disputed. I completely agree with their sentiment, but why they're saying this is because it goes against the grain of what everyone else is saying. They're often doing it in a point for clickbait. Someone who's not that relevant or looking to sell more books comes out disputing what a calorie is. It gets a lot of attention in media. And if you look into what they're saying, it's not actually what they mean. And so a kilometer is a kilometer. Now, on the Tour de France, not every kilometer is the same. You ask an athlete that's doing it, kilometer one, kilometer 69, were they the same? Well, as far as distance, they were completely the same. Oh, but one was uphill and one was downhill. Okay, but we're not disputing the distance. We still can't say, well, it's not really a kilometer because it was downhill. We're still talking about the distance between two points. So no one's going to say a kilometer is not 1,000 meters, because you've completely undone the entire structure of what it is. Going into the second argument, how calories are treated differently, no one's disputing this. In my camp of everything that I believe, two calories of two different foods are completely differently utilized by my body. And I completely agree again that between yourself and myself, there could be a completely different change. Someone who's got Crohn's or ulcerative colitis or any condition of inflammation in their digestive tract cannot extract the calories from food. But that doesn't mean we completely tear down the entire system of calorie contents of food because someone's not getting the same amount of calories from it than me. And even if we were to use pork as that exact same example, if you're taking 92 calories from that and I'm taking 100, although the science is different, I guarantee if we implemented the same protocols between us, we would elicit the same goal. And almonds, for instance, no human being can extract and digest the full calorie amount from almonds. Does that mean we shouldn't eat them? Does it mean we shouldn't count them? So many people overlook the grand scheme of things, that with a framework that you give to people that are struggling to get some basis of control on their intake and their habits, if they see a net improvement, why are we kind of going back over it and trying to dispel something? There's obviously a narrative here. And unfortunately, the thing I said before about the consumer and the principle, I can't help but feel that these people are trying to disrupt the principle and make that rocky so they can insert their method in between the consumer and the information they need.
In defense of them both, I think they're both trying to find the science of it. Tim Spector is obsessed with the microbiomes in your gut. He's doing so much research on that. And the predict study I was doing when I got all the information back, which was abundant, I must say, it was a lot of it. They did a lot of emphasis on the fact of how the bacteria was in my gut. And the reason they're doing this, and I think this is fascinating, is they're linking bad, good bacteria to, sorry, if you don't have enough good bacteria, they're linking it to disease quite a lot. And so this is like why they're looking at so much in diet. And what's interesting, which will fascinate you, is when I talked to Dr. Tim Spector about all this stuff, he always says there's so few studies and research done on diet. There's not enough, bearing in mind we've got a nation of people who are getting more obese, and you know, and we've got sort of, I don't know, like diabetes 2 coming and stuff like that. There should be much more studies into what actually we're consuming and how it's good for us.
Yeah, and do you know what, I completely agree about the kind of gut microbiome and everything that's going on. However, again, with that kind of analogy of the leaky bathrooms, if I was to talk to all of the people in the United Kingdom in one go who have got a BMI that across averages is a pretty good predictor of someone's health and obesity, their anomalies, England rugby team, myself, whatever, I go to them and I say, hey guys, let's work on your gut microbiome. I'm going to get told to fuck off by all of them, almost all of them. And unfortunately, I don't think people care enough at this point. What they care about is fitting into a seat on a plane. What they care about is not being petrified at the gym. What they care about is waking up and knowing that they have some form of control over their day. What they care about is being able to exercise and appreciate the endorphins that come from it. I think that probably the work that Tim Spector is doing is fucking fantastic, but I don't think he is talking to the problems of the nation in which we have. He could be completely right with everything he's saying. But ultimately, if we get people better habits and we reduce their level of obesity, their health markers across anything that you would include in a test are going to improve. Ultimately, they're going to improve. And that in itself is probably going to be a motivator enough for people to eat better and improve their digestion and have a more balanced diet. For me, I think that the main emphasis we need to put on people of this nation and people that need the help is to initially reduce their levels of obesity. And the reason that type 2 diabetes is so prevalent is that the body's organs cannot do its job, because the circulatory system in the human body is a bit like the London Underground, let's call it. Passengers on, passengers off. No one stays on the London Underground fucking longer than they need to. No one. We have oxygen getting off, carbon dioxide getting on, you know, all of these things. We have food going in, all going around. When someone's level of obesity gets to a certain point, passengers cannot get off onto fat tissue anymore. They can't. Fat tissue is like, we've had enough. We cannot store anymore. And it can't get off at muscle tissue because people are too sedentary and they're not exercising. And because of that, energy remains in circulation. Now, when the circulatory system now becomes a storage system, it's like rush hour on the London Underground when passengers can't get off. And that is what's causing the highest chances of cardiovascular disease, stroke, and heart attack. Because the type 2 definition is there to let people know they're a much higher class of these bad things happening to them. If people can get an understanding that reducing their level of obesity allows even just their heart and circulatory system to fucking function properly, then I think we can move into, you know, let's look at these foods. Let's look at your gut microbiota. Let's look at your sleep. Let's look at all of these. But I think that we're literally splitting hairs over something that is far too advanced for the majority of the nation to even be thinking about, let alone who can have their shit sample fucking looked at by a doctor or afford it.
Yeah, all right. We've come to the end, but I'm just going to say one thing on that, which is fascinating. Is both Dr. Giles Yeo says we have literally, I think he said this. No, I'm speaking on behalf of him, which I hate, but we have no idea how much someone's suffering with hunger. Like when you get hungry, we don't know how painful it is in comparison to me, because we can't be in each other's. You know, we don't know how big your sex drive is to the next guy. I think it's pretty big, judging by your Instagram. But you know, we just don't know. And the other thing is that the which they're looking into, which I think is fascinating always, is the fetal transplants, where they're going to stick feces, because they think often that you're we'll hold this conversation off the podcast, but they think often your microbiome, the stuff going on in your thing, can actually make you more hungry if it's bad, if you've got a bad environment in there rather than a good one. If you get a good one, it can suppress your hunger.
Joe, I'll leave with a controversial statement.
Whoa, no, don't do it.
Like, I think that we, seem to think in our society, a lot of people have an alcohol problem and a lot of people have drug problems. And we very much blame drugs and alcohol, but we never look over the point that we might have a massive unemployment problem and a purpose problem. And I honestly believe that if you could take a certain percentage of the United Kingdom who have drug and alcohol problems and give them a job they love and purpose, they would stop their old habits, because every human being wants to do well. Every human being wants to do well.
That's not controversial. Yeah, I mean, we did Johan Hari on my podcast discuss that. Yeah,
it's a counterpoint.
Yeah,
I think that the obese people that we have and the overweight people and those that are really struggling and the ones that have got really bad bits of health, I believe if we give them a system that works, that supports them and educates them to the point that they understand what's happening, that the work will take care of itself. And I think we need to be looking at those frameworks more than just saying obesity, levels of hunger, you know, gut microbiota, poor genetics. I think we need to come down a level and just give people the systems in place. And I think some people are just missing that.
I agree. And I remember on Sunday brunch once saying, I just only eat food now. And they went, what do you mean? I said, well, I've just given up everything else. I just eat food. And they said, what are you talking about? And I said, well, I just don't eat crisps and stuff like that anymore. And they looked at me and I'm like, but it's not food, is it? I mean, like, come on, it's so calorific for what it is. It's a ridiculous idea, isn't it, to put crisps in your diet, don't you think?
Yeah. And I think that, you know, for me, it's just something I do with my parents. But I don't eat crisps because, again, I couldn't put that in my shopping basket because it's a bad deal to me. I'm like, this
that's how I feel. That's how I feel.
When I go see my mum and dad at the weekend and we're having a Sunday roast, I'm like, mum, where's the crisp and dip?
James, lovely to speak to you. We should do it again because it's a great chat. If people want to get in contact with you, I suppose Instagram's the best at the moment, is it?
Yeah, just if they type in James Smith or James Smith PT anywhere, I'm sure they'll come across to me.
Top man. And then you can sign up to his apps and read his books and everything else. Cheers, James. Thank you so much.
Cheers. Thank you, mate.